right. Matthew chapter 10, verse 23. I left you guys with a little bit of a cliffhanger yesterday. So let me kind of review the cliff and then we'll begin to hang from it again. Right now, we are in the second major discourse in the Gospel of Matthew. He has just commissioned his 12 disciples, which was hammered on the first five verses, to go out and preach to what? What is their specific target audience? The lost sheep of Israel. Exactly, the lost sheep of Israel. And as he's going, he talks about what they are to do if the people reject them, what they are to do if the people accept them, and we ended with verse 23, but verse 23 is kind of a bridge because the last half of this discourse is going to be talking a lot about the divisiveness of the message of Jesus. We're going to talk a lot about persecution. Hopefully we'll get into chapter 11 where some of this will start to, the rubber will start to meet the road. Bottom line is, we are in verse 23. Verse 23, the last 100 years, has been a major verse in New Testament studies. Major, major verse. Let me read it out loud and I'll tell you why it was major, give you the two options we did yesterday, and give you the third option that I think's right. When you are persecuted in one place, notice the word when attached to you are persecuted. It's not, you might be persecuted. Jesus goes, oh, trust me. You start saying a message like I've got out loud, persecution's going to be a coming. It's just the way it is. Why? Because whenever you're announcing another king in another kingdom, and you have other kings and kingdoms reigning, there's going to be conflict. When you are persecuted in one place, flee to another. Go to the next. I tell you the truth. Here is the big verse, the big part of the verse. You will not finish going through the cities of Israel before the Son of Man comes. On the surface, what does that sound like? What does that mean, though? Son of Man coming. What does that mean? On the surface. On the surface. I'm hitting at the first option that people usually land on. The second coming. As a matter of fact, if you look in verse 22, it says, all men will hate you because of me, but he who stands firm to the end will be saved. And then he comes on and he starts talking about the Son of Man coming. The first option suggests that Jesus made a prophetic prediction that before they will even end their ministry, that the second coming, that the establishment of the kingdom, all that the second coming brings would happen. And that would mean that the kingdom of God would be reigning on earth by implementing what, you know, the Jews were longing for. This Messiah reigning on the throne, the exaltation of Israel, the destruction of the enemies. Jesus, so the first option says, predicts that this will happen before they end their ministry. And as the story goes, the first option says that Jesus was shocked when they returned. When they returned, Jesus was like, oh, okay, well, plan B, you know. I guess this cross thing may really actually happen. Okay, well, let's figure this out now. That's kind of how it goes. Now, is this a viable option? Yes. Do not hear my facetiousness as saying that I don't think that this is possible. I just don't think that it's likely. Is it possible? From a historian's perspective, not from a theologian's perspective, from a historian's perspective, yes, it is possible. However, I give you a couple reasons why I don't agree with this. Number one, I think that this violates the entire trajectory of how Jesus has defined the kingdom thus far. That it would be odd that Jesus' goal at this point in Matthew would be the same goal as the Jewish kingdom after he has at this point kind of contradicted the Jewish kingdom and how it's supposed to come to be. So number one, I don't think it makes sense because I think it would change what Jesus brought as far as the kingdom. Number two, I don't think it makes sense because this assumes that the kingdom is supposed to be established at one time. But that is clearly antithetical to the way in which the kingdom has been elaborated on and will be elaborated on as we keep going. That it is not a one-time moment. It was established at his birth, but it is establishing. It was established in his ministry, but it's establishing. It's established in the disciples' ministry, but it is establishing. Matter of fact, when we get to Matthew 13, when he's using the parables of the kingdom, he uses parables that describe the progression, the process, like a mustard seed, that when it is planted, it's not like, bam, now the mustard seed is a full mustard tree. No. It has to grow, expand. Same thing with yeast and the dough. The kingdom is one that progresses, that moves progressively. Third reason why I don't think this makes much sense, the first option, that Jesus made a false prediction, is this just would be, as a good historian, we should always give the author some sense the benefit of the doubt. Now, I shouldn't say always. We should take a more chastised position of what we know compared to what the author knows. It is ludicrous to us to think that we have a better perspective on the truth of the way history progressed than the author did that was living in the history that he was writing about. What I mean by that is this. Doesn't it seem odd that Matthew, who is, in a sense, writing the book to show who Jesus is and the establishment of the kingdom, validating the ministry that he followed, wouldn't it be weird if he was like, oh, remember the time whenever Jesus made a false prediction? That was awesome. It's just weird. Why, if I'm just being honest here, if I was trying to perpetuate what I knew was probably not exactly accurate, I would try to get rid of all the inaccuracies. I would gloss over them. Why? Because there's a lot riding when it comes to Matthew and his life and identity on the truth of the story of Jesus. So if he's writing a book and he can choose any of the moments out of the 3 years in which he lived, out of the 1,000 days that he lived with Jesus, why would he pick the moment that Jesus made a false prediction? As a historian, I should probably say, maybe the prediction's not false. Maybe I'm not looking at this from with the right lens. I thought of a fourth reason this morning. I wrote it down. Let me read it out loud and see if I agree with it really quick. Because, you know, sometimes you write stuff at 5:30 in the morning and it's not always right. We would have to assume that on the... Oh, yeah. We would also have to assume that on this first trip, they would be hitting all the cities of Israel. Right? As a matter of fact, Jesus says, I tell you the truth, you will not finish going through the cities of Israel. Now, here's my question. What cities are they going through? What cities are they going through? What? Well, let me ask this question. What key city will they not be going through? Huh. Isn't that strange that Jesus would say that the kingdom of heaven is going to be established and they're not even going to take the message to Jerusalem? They're going to be setting up camp in the temple of Jerusalem, but they're not even going to get there with the mission before the Son of Man makes the second coming? You see how that's weird? All of these start to make me think that there's something bigger that we're not looking at. That this is moving beyond just this mission, that this is bigger than what we're looking at. The second option, which I reject, is that this people will say, and this is actually, this second option is what you will find in more of the conservative commentaries. And I think actually the second option is less viable than the first one. The second option says that he is talking about the second coming, but he's saying that their mission to the cities of Israel is actually also kind of a metonymy or a smaller portion of the bigger reality, that they're actually supposed to take the message to the ends of the earth. And that this will extend throughout all their lifetimes, and then once they finally do this, then Jesus will come back. Actually, they won't even complete that mission, and then Jesus will come back. Why do I reject that? It was even hard for me to get it all out. Why would I reject that?
It's not what they're taking out of context. Like,
yeah.
Trying to expand it for more than what it actually is in the text.
You're exactly right. Exactly right. I have to add in the Gentile mission because the first 23 verses have been very clear where this mission is supposed to be going to, right? It's not to the Gentiles at all. Because in context, Jesus is talking about the disciples' mission to the lost sheep of Israel. Therefore, taking the phrase, the cities of Israel, and expanding that to the Gentile mission is simply ignoring the context. Absolutely ignoring it. Does it make more sense to them on a theological perspective? Sure. But what they're trying to do is they're trying to take something out of context and apply it to all contexts. And that's dangerous. The second reason why is because I don't even think we're talking second coming. Because the word end in verse 22, every time it is used in the Gospel of Matthew, every time it is used, we'll talk about this in more in detail once we get to chapter 13, but it is never used to talk about the second coming. It is always used to talk about the end of a process. As a matter of fact, in chapter 26, it will be used to describe the end of the trials of Jesus. Not the end of everything. This is the word telos. There is another word that consistently throughout Matthew is always used to refer to the end of everything, the consummation of the end of the age, the second coming, and that is the word soonteleia. Soonteleia, the end of the ages, is the way it's described, or it's used twice in Matthew 13, once in Matthew 24, and then it's even used once again in Matthew chapter 28. I will be with you even until the end of the age. Soonteleia, the end of everything. So even the word that's being used here says that this may not be talking about the end the way we think the word end is talking about. See, we have the same problem when it comes to the word new. The word end, and I'm just talking English language here, and the word new, look them up in the dictionary. And see how many definitions that you get for these, seemingly easy words. I know for a fact new, you can get up to 14 definitions in the English language for this word alone. But we think that every time we see the word new, we know exactly what it means. Same thing with the word end. The word end, you'll get a half a dozen to a dozen definitions just of the word end. But we think we know what it means every time it comes up, that the end means the end. Guess what? In the Bible, the word forever doesn't always mean forever. Let that one sink in for a minute. Do a word study on forever. Trust me, it'll take you forever. I just used the word there and it didn't mean forever and I did it. How do we know what words mean? Context. We can read anything that we want into chapter 10, 22, and 23. But what I want to know is what we're reading into it actually makes sense with the whole trajectory of what Matthew has already painted thus far? Here's option three. Couple of clues. Number one, what do you notice is significant about verse 23 that my eye immediately runs to because I'm thinking like a good Jewish person? What does my eye immediately run to in verse 23? Yes, Son of Man. And the word comes. The coming of the Son of Man. Where is my mind immediately running to as a Jew? Messiah, but what Old Testament passage? Daniel, chapter 7. I'm actually coming to think that outside of Psalm 110, this may be the most important Old Testament passage for understanding who Jesus is. I'm starting to come to this conclusion. Matter of fact, yeah, I will say I've come to that conclusion. I honestly think that even though Psalm 110 is quoted more, that this one is actually more important for us to understand how it functions. So we're going to read it again because it's that important. Daniel chapter 7. What has happened so far of the first 12 verses of Daniel? What's Daniel experiencing right now? A vision. And what happens in the first several verses? He sees a vision of what? Four beasts coming from where? The sea. And the fourth one is brutal, vicious. But then he sees a glimmer of hope and of light. Verse 13. In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. Listen to why this is significant. This is the only time in the entire Old Testament, the only time that the words Son of Man and coming are together. These are the only time. This is the only time. These verses are the only verses in the entire Old Testament when the word Son of Man is attached to the one that is coming, ever. Therefore, this is a pretty important term. Whenever Son of Man is evoked with the words coming, we probably should think it through this lens. Right? Does that make sense? Is that logical in any way, shape, or form? Yeah. I hope you agree with me on that. The one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. I've done this before. I'm going to do it again. Where is he coming to? To heaven from earth. How do I know that? Because where does he go? In the presence of the Ancient of Days. And where is the Ancient of Days in this vision? Heaven. So whenever I see the word Son of Man coming, we immediately, because we are somewhat selfish, think he must be coming to me. But the word coming is a directional term. You have to ask the question, not just where is he coming from, but where is he coming to? Right? We look at everything through our perspective, but in this, it shows us the Son of Man coming on the clouds to heaven from earth. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. Listen to the stuff that he gets. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. What is this describing? The establishment of the kingdom of God that will last forever. You see why that's important? Flip back to Matthew chapter 10, verse 23. Jesus says, I tell you the truth, you will not finish going through the cities of Israel before the Son of Man comes. First question, comes where? Comes where? To heaven, from earth. And what happens at that moment? It is the inception of the kingdom that is establishing. It is a moment of establishment that also symbolizes the establishing that is already happening and that will continue to happen. So what is Jesus saying will happen before they go through the cities of Israel? The kingdom will be established even before you finish the mission. But what does that also imply? That the mission continues even after the kingdom is established. Huh. So I'm suggesting that Jesus is saying the exact opposite. That he is not expecting that everything stops before they come back to him. I am suggesting that Jesus is actually saying the same thing he has said and will say about the kingdom. And that is, the kingdom is being established. Don't think that just because you're going to the cities of Israel, that all of a sudden now the kingdom will be here. No, the kingdom is being established. It will be being established. Matter of fact, the moment that you're looking for, it'll happen even before you make it through the cities of Israel. And they would immediately have thought what? How does that make sense? I thought the kingdom was for Israel. How could we not tell all the word to all of Israel before the kingdom's established? And Jesus looks at them and says this, because the kingdom is not attached to their ethnic identity. It is attached to me. You see what he's saying? He's saying the kingdom is bigger than the nation of Israel that currently exists. It's not just about them. You won't even finish telling the word to all of them. You won't even make it to Jerusalem before the kingdom is totally established. Trust me. This mission is not the end-all be-all. Simon the Zealot, calm down. Don't start bringing people with arms to fight. That's not what this mission's about. It's bigger than Israel. It's not attached to them. It's attached to me. So more than making a prediction, he's revealing something about his kingdom and about who he is. Tracking with me? All right. You don't have to agree with me. That's okay. I won't lose sleep. But we need to keep moving. So, chapter 10, 24. The reason why I land on that, though, is that makes more sense to me historically of what Matthew could be saying. Historically, what he is saying is something about the kingdom more than he is about a false prediction. I think it's a very limited perspective where we're trying to find somewhere where Jesus is wrong. And granted, somebody will accuse me of saying, you're just trying to protect inerrancy. Well, you can accuse that all you want. Although you may need to get to know me a little better. Verse 24. A student is not above his teacher, nor a servant above his master. It is enough for the student to be like his teacher, and the servant like his master. If the head of the house has been called Beelzebub, how much more the members of this household? Here is my question. What is the context of these verses? Because it almost sounds like because of what I had to go off on a rabbit trail on because of scholarship, we can almost get disjointed of what Jesus has been talking about and will talk about. What is he referring to here? Persecution. Because even what begins verse 23 is when you are persecuted. So we get sidetracked at the last half of verse 23. But we don't need to be sidetracked. Right here he's saying, a student is not above his teacher, nor a servant above his master. As a matter of fact, he says, how much more in verse 25? What is he saying? What is Jesus laying out for them?
He's going to be persecuted.
Listen, Jesus is saying, I'm being persecuted. You guys are seeing it. The Pharisees are coming at me like crazy. As a matter of fact, we've already had the phrase where it said the Pharisees started to plot against him to kill him. He's saying, you guys have seen how people aren't too excited about what I'm saying. And he says, do you honestly think you're going to be exempt from that? Are you better than your master? No, if your master's being called Beelzebub, the prince of demons, how much more will you be overwhelmed with the viciousness of persecution? Where has Jesus been called Beelzebub so far? Huh? Chapter 9, exactly right. Chapter 9, verse 34. But the Pharisees said, after seeing the miraculous events, it is by the prince of demons he drives out demons. And he will be fully called Beelzebub, the full frontal attack, in chapter 12. But we'll get there, hopefully, after your test. So, Jesus is saying, how much more? That is very Jewish. Very Jewish to do a how much more. It's a typical rabbinic way of interpreting things, both scripture and history. If the head of the house has been called Beelzebub, the prince of demons, how much more the members of his household? In other words, he's saying, I'm not exempt from the persecution, but you're probably going to catch it worse, especially on the mission you're about to go on. Don't take it out of the context of the mission he's sending them on. Don't take it out of the context of the mission he's sending them on. Verse 26. So do not be afraid. I'm going to read 26 through 31 and tell me what sticks out to you the most. So do not be afraid of them. There is nothing concealed that will not be disclosed or hidden that will not be made known. That's why they need to be innocent as doves. What I tell you in the dark, speak in the daylight. What is whispered in your ear, proclaim from the rooftops. Do not be afraid of those who could kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather, be afraid of the one who can destroy both soul and body in hell. Are not two sparrows sold for a penny? Yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from the will of the Father. And even the very hairs of your head are all numbered. So don't be afraid. You are worth more than sparrows. What's his key point in these five verses? What? Don't be afraid. He mentions it three times at the beginning, middle, and end. Why would fear be a logical consequence of what's preceded? Yeah, he's looking at them and he's saying this. You're getting ready to go out on a mission to proclaim the kingdom to the house of Israel. And guess what? They're going to come at you. They're going to drag you in front of governors. They're going to possibly flog you. You may even be facing death. I mean, my word, if I've been called Beelzebub, what are they going to do to you? And all of a sudden they're going, I'm sorry, what mission are we going on again? Are you sending, do you have a death wish for us? You know what I'm saying? They're kind of like, I'm sorry, you're telling me that you're sending us out to the wolves? I thought you were a shepherd. And Jesus says, don't be afraid. Why should they not be afraid? What is his primary point of why they should not be afraid? Say it again.
They're worth more than sparrows.
Yes, to God. Because he takes the most insignificant body, a sparrow, who is sold, two of them are sold for a penny. Two of them. And he says, and yet not one of them falls without the will of God controlling that. What is he saying? You can almost hear a how much more in there, can't you? How much more than for you? It's not just that you're a human. It's that you're sons of the kingdom. You think he's going to take care of the sparrows more than he's going to take care of the sons of the kingdom? How much more will he take care of you? Ultimately, what he's saying is this. Become completely, absolutely unprepared for this mission. Why? Because in the kingdom of God, it is all about complete reliance on God. Period. Matter of fact, in everything, because of who God is, he is the only one that truly deserves to be feared. This is a key ploy of the devil to convince us that he deserves to have our fear. That he is powerful enough and has authority over us enough that we should fear him. And what Jesus says is there is only one that you fear, and that is God himself. Why? Because he has control not just of your body, he does, but he also has control of your soul. You think you should fear Satan who can only kill you? What about the one that can send your soul into eternal punishment? Shouldn't you fear that one too? And yet, what does the God of all creation, the one we should be fearing, tell us to do? don't fear. So if the only one that deserves to be feared looks at you and says, you don't need to fear, then what do you have to fear? Nothing. Nothing. That would get some people all ready to go for persecuting moments. Whoever acknowledges me before men, I will also acknowledge him before my Father in heaven. But whoever disowns me before men, I will disown him before my Father in heaven. Now Jesus just said, you have persecution coming. You don't need to fear because God's in control. But let me be very clear. Your mission is something that is huge. I've told you to go out and tell about the King and the kingdom. And if you disown me in front of the people because of persecution, you're not a part of my family. Why? Because I will judge you by your fruit. And what you do to me, I'll do to you. You disown me, I'll disown you. Yeah?
What about Peter?
What about Peter?
He disowned
three times.
Yeah. Let me guess.
Oh, no, I was just going to ask one question. Does Jesus say this is the unforgivable sin? There we go. Moving on, right? Yeah. All right. Because John chapter 21 is a pretty important passage in the life of Peter. Do you love me, Peter? Feed my sheep. Do you love me, Peter? Feed my sheep. Do you really love me? Then feed my sheep. It's the reinstitution of Peter. Okay. Good question, though. Good question. We don't have time. Okay, verse 34. Do not suppose that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. Okay. Three minutes? Yeah, our test is going to be on Wednesday. If I hear this passage used to describe that Jesus is okay with violence, I'm going to scream. Okay? Just hear me very carefully. There are better passages to argue from than this one. Okay? trying to keep my emotions intact. Here is the irony that Jesus is presenting. The Pax Romana of Rome, they come claiming to bear peace, to give peace. And how do they do it? By killing people with a sword. And Jesus says the ironic opposite. He says, I don't come to bring peace. I come with a sword. But what is the sword in this context?
Truth.
Yeah. The message of the kingdom. Isn't it? Isn't it? Is Jesus standing there leaning on a broadsword when he's saying this? Is he? What is taking away the peace in the lives of Jesus and his family and those around him? What is causing division? The message of the kingdom of Jesus. This is why in Revelation chapter 1, Revelation 19, coming out of the mouth of Jesus is a sword. No, he is not a sword swallower. He's got a message that divides, that causes wars, that gets people killed. But all throughout this context, who is the one being killed and who is the one killing? The disciples are the ones that are being persecuted. Right? We pull stuff out of context and we make up whatever we want and it drives me insane. It's annoying. If we honestly think that this word means the same thing in every context and this word means the same thing in every context and this word means the same thing in every context, we don't understand how language works. Does that make sense? Good grief. Okay. For I have come to turn a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies will be the members of his own household. Where does this come from? Micah chapter 7, verse 6. Micah chapter 7, verse 6. At this point in Micah, you have the case against Israel in chapter 6. You have the pronounced guilt and punishment in chapter 6. Then comes verse 7. Jesus says this. Micah says this. What misery is mine? I am like one who gathers summer fruit at the gleaning of the vineyard, but there is no cluster of grapes to eat, none of the early figs that I crave. What is it? The vineyard, which is a key symbol of Israel, is not producing fruit. The godly have swept from the land. Not one upright man remains. Listen to how he describes their unrighteousness from here on out. All men lie in wait to shed blood. Each hunts his brother with a net. Both hands are skilled in doing evil. The ruler demands gifts. The judge accepts bribes. The powerful dictate that what they desire. They all conspire together. In other words, it's a kingdom in disarray. The best of them is like a briar, the most upright worse than a thorn hedge. The day of your watchman has come, the day God visits you. Do you hear that? In the midst of a chaotic, bloodthirsty kingdom, the watchman appears on the scene, and God has come to visit them. His name may be Emmanuel. Now is the time of their confusion. Do not trust a neighbor, put no confidence in a friend. Even with her who lies in your embrace, be careful of your words. For a son dishonors his father, a daughter rises up against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, a man's enemies are the members of his own household. So God comes, and what happens? More confusion and division within the kingdom itself. But then verse 7 of Micah comes. But as for me, I watch and hope for the Lord. I wait for God, my Savior, and my God will hear me. In the midst of chaos, there is a voice of hope. And Jesus is saying, that is my voice. That's what I've come to bring. Will it incite chaos? Absolutely. Will people start turning on each other, even within their own families? Absolutely. But ultimately, what He is bringing is the peace that will set them free. Even though it may have people turn on them. Okay. Oh, mercy. Okay. Anyone who loves his father. Really quick, let me do verse 37 and 38, 39. Anyone who loves his father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who loves his son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And anyone who does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds his life will lose. No, I'm not going to do that. Okay. Okay, I'll see you guys tomorrow. We'll start there.